think that bringing this, that language into this bill would jeopardize the most important purpose of it, and that is to have a procedure for selecting juries in capital punishment cases that would ensure the protection of the defendant's rights in those cases. And for those two reasons, I oppose the amendments.
Okay, is there further discussion? If not, the clerk will call the roll on Representative Miller's motion.
Hill?
No.
Kaminsky?
No.
Miller?
Aye.
Peterson?
No.
Phillips?
Aye.
Spear?
No. Motion fails. Further motions? Further discussion? Representative Hill?
Mr. Chairman, move House Bill 2873 to the full committee with a due pass recommendation as amended.
Thank you. Representative Hill moves House Bill 2873 as amended to the full committee with a due pass recommendation. Further discussion? If not, the clerk will call the roll.
Hill?
Aye.
Kaminsky?
Aye.
Miller?
No.
Peterson?
Aye.
Phillips?
Aye.
Aye. Motion is adopted. Can we put that on for Wednesday? Okay, we need to do so. Okay, we've got 2429. And we got some witnesses signed up because we House Bill, for the record and for members' information, House Bill 3006 was introduced late in the session. It was printed and referred to this committee about a week or two ago. It relates generally to the same subject as it relates to probation or parole of sex offenders. It was introduced at the request of the Governor's Commission on Violent Crime. And we had several phone calls and inquiries as to whether or not we were going to deal with that issue or that bill. And it was suggested to those who asked to testify on 3006 that we had already before us a bill that dealt generally with that same topic, 2429, and that when we scheduled 2429 for a work session, we would allow folks to testify on 3006 and see whether or not the committee wished to amend one until the other or see how we choose to deal with that subject generally. So, Mr. Kornblut, I think you have brought with you some folks. If you wouldn't mind waiting just a moment, though, since Mr. Gillette has come here at a time certain at our request, I think we'll take that one out of order. If that's okay, it shouldn't take too long, I hope. This is on House Bill 2126. Counselor, if you could just tell us where we're at on this.
All right, we've had two hearings on 2126. Chief Judge Joseph appeared before the committee to support the bill, as it did, we had a letter from James Mountain from the Department of Justice. The committee was asked to consider an amendment on lines 10 and line 15 to change the language that says unconstitutionally cruel or unusual to unconstitutionally cruel and unusual, because that's the way it was historically written, and there was apparently a historical typographical error that was just caught this session. We should have a letter dated March 11th from Judge Joseph, which says there isn't a conflict between this bill and the Senate Bill 257, which establishes criteria for the imposition of consecutive sentences. And we also had a statement in writing from the ACLU which opposes 2126.
Okay, Council, to add to your statement, I think in terms of changing language from board to and, we also need to read a little further into the bill down to lines 21, 26, and 28. Okay, Judge Gillette?
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Michael Gillette. I'm the judge of the Court of Appeals. I'm appearing here today on behalf of Judge Joseph, who is out of the state. I'm here mostly to respond to questions the committee may have. I simply want to point out to the committee that this bill is designed to have the law state what the present practice is before the Court of Appeals. Presently, the law purports to authorize my court both to review sentences for unconstitutionality and also to review them, although it doesn't put it quite that way, for proportionality. But the fact is that we are simply not an appropriately constituted body to review sentences for proportionality other than on a constitutional basis, simply because we don't have a frame of reference from which to determine whether any particular sentence is proportional to all others or not. That is a function the parole board can perform, at least better, if not wholly adequately, with regard to felony sentences. I confess to you frankly that there is no body who can perform the function with respect to misdemeanor sentences, since there is no central body involved in the state for administering probationers or those sentenced for misdemeanor crimes. But I can assure you, whether there is another body or not, we are not the one.
Okay. Judge, have you had an opportunity, or have you testified on Senate Bill 257?
I have had an opportunity to examine the bill. I have not testified on it. I can find no conflict between the two. 2126 is really concerned with a different problem.
Okay. Are there any questions at this point for the judge? And counsel, were there any other amendments other than to change the or language on the lines indicated to and?
Not as I recall, and certain, I don't have anything in my notes that suggests that the committee acted or had proposed before it other language to amend the bill.
Jack Kowalski, I guess I have a question for Judge Gillette. It just seems to me that if we do this, that what we'll see is a lot more plea bargaining and a lot heavier sentencing without any rational basis to it in reality. I think that's a fair assessment.
No, I don't think that'll happen at all.
What do you think will happen?
I think the availability of an appeal on the size of the sentence is chimerical. I don't believe anyone makes a decision to plead guilty based on that fact. I would be stunned if anybody did.
But it's sort of like nobody, Mr. Chair.
Representative Kibetsky.
Judge, it seems like nobody's going to be watching. Right now, there's sort of this feeling out there that, well, at least, you know, the Court of Appeals is watching. If we get too outlandish, we get smacked down a little bit. But.
Well, let me point out to you that it depends on what it is you want to have watched. The present statute authorizes us to review both felony and misdemeanor sentences. With respect to felony sentences, as I indicated in my previous testimony, the body in a better position to make any judgment at all as to proportionality is the parole board, since they see a broad range of sentences on every imaginable felony, and therefore have a frame of reference to determine whether a particular sentence makes much sense, and they have fairly complete guidelines as to the adjustments that are made by a trial judge, including immediately releasing a prisoner if they find that a sentence is just wholly disproportionate to other sentences for the same offense, at least. We're in no position to do that because we don't see those other cases in any kind of framework which permits us to review individual sentences. So, at least with respect to felonies, there's a body that can do what perhaps the present legislation assumes will do. With respect to misdemeanors, you're entirely correct. There is no other body to substitute for us. The difficulty with that, however, as a practice, is that I cannot believe for a second that anybody either pleads guilty to a misdemeanor based upon the availability of our review of their sentence, or any judge ever imposes a sentence in a misdemeanor even thinking about the availability of review. Those just aren't considerations that go into the process as to whether there could be a sentence, as to whether there could be a sentence which was disproportionate but not unconstitutional as to a misdemeanor. Representative Kopeski, I have a hard time intellectually creating that beast. Maybe so, but boy, I sure have a hard time imagining him.
Mr. Chair.
Sure. Representative Kopeski.
I have heard. I had to be careful when I start talking about judges. I was down there testifying in front of Ways and Means this morning for their retirement package, and I almost slipped up. I have heard that there are some judges out there. I mean, you know, they don't have to worry about what they sentence because they know that they go up, and if the guy's out on parole, they just blame the parole board. And some of the judges know good and well what matrix is, or has a fair idea of what the matrix is, and so that, you know, they can give a real harsh sentence and say, boy, you know, I really showed that guy, you know, he comes into our county, he commits a crime, we're gonna really nail him, knowing full well how the matrix operates, and then somebody comes up and says, well, you know, I did my part as a pro boy to let him out. It just seems like we're fostering that whole syndrome and saying to the judges, you know, letting them off the hook and saying, you do whatever you want, we really decide our sentencing at the pro board now.
Well, treat you guys as a question.
Yes.
Let me try to offer a structured answer.
As opposed to an unstructured question.
Which may be beyond my capacity, but I'll do the best I can. The phenomenon of disparate sentences for the same offense measured from county to county is a circumstance which arises out of the plurality that we have as a political entity. The Court of Appeals is not a unifying force with respect to that. The phenomenon of judges who are locally elected and who may therefore take into consideration local circumstances in passing sentence on individual felons is not something we can correct. Candidly, I don't think it's even something you can correct. As long as judges are elected from localities, they will, to a degree, represent the views of their constituents, as to a degree, this body represents the views of its constituents. It is also true, however, I like to think, that judges in the broad range of cases far more commonly represent exactly what the law expects them to, just as this body commonly votes based upon the consciences of the individual members, whatever their electorate may expect them. Now, the fact that in an individual case, a trial judge may, because he knows something about the matrix, award a sentence which he thinks works the matrix so that he gives the individual the maximum amount of time the individual, that he wants the individual to have, doesn't say anything about our authority at all, because one, it may be wholly appropriate for the individual to get exactly the amount of time the judge intends. Secondly, the appropriateness or inappropriateness of that sentence is a matter which can be viewed in light of two different criteria. The first is the nature of the offender himself, which is something we are in no position to assess, even on the basis of a pre-sentence report, the way the judge is who's seen the individual. And secondly, the nature of the offense. We're in a better position to assess that, I suppose, relatively speaking, but again, in no better position than he is. So you have two criteria, one on which we can't improve upon his knowledge, and the other upon which we cannot match it. And under those circumstances, our review is, if not wholly uninformed, at least less informed than is his decision, whatever it is. If the sentence he hands down is unconstitutional, or if it exceeds the maximum which you have chosen to make available for that offense under the criminal statutes, then this bill would retain our authority to deal with that. And we have had a couple of cases where a judge inadvertently imposed, say, a Class B felony penalty on a Class C felony, because sometimes it's sort of hard to keep track of which or what. I don't recall a case in which we've ever struck down a sentence as just plain being unconstitutional. We have never said a word about a sentence being disproportionate, and I cannot hold out any particular optimism that we ever would, whether the present statute remained on the books or not. And the reason is, as I suggest, because I don't know how to do that. I don't have the tools to, well, I'm sorry, I do too know how to do that. As a judge, I'm not given the tools to do it.
Okay. Thank you.
Are there further questions? If not, thank you very much, Judge. Let's take a motion on the amendments to adopt the language "and" instead of "or," where it appears in the bill between the words "cruel" and "unusual," and the chair would so move those amendments. Any discussion on that amendment? This appears on lines 10, 15, 21, 26, and 28.
Any objection to that amendment? If not, it's adopted. The reason that this, in part, that this bill had been held was to see what was going to happen in part on Senate Bill 257 and to make sure there was no conflict.
I just want to reiterate, for purposes of the intent, Judge Joseph's statement that, in his judgment, any sentence imposed under the authority granted in 257 would be reviewable under the standard that appears in 2126, quote, "In the new language, exceeds the maximum sentence allowable by law," and, end quote. So I think certainly this committee's action would endorse that statement of intent. On 257, I'm advised that it had a hearing last week in the Senate Committee. This bill relates, 257 relates to consecutive sentencing, and as I understand it, is the top priority of the Oregon District Attorneys Association. It's not clear yet whether or not there's going to be a work session on the Senate side, and at the request of the proponents and upon the chair's motion, I'm going to ask that the substance of 257 be prepared as amendments to 2126, they have the same relating clause, and we consider that as an amendment on Wednesday. This is not to do any damage to 2126. It's done with good intentions, and so we'll prepare that for the Wednesday Subcommittee One hearing. And Mr. Penn, you might want to be available to answer questions on the consecutive sentencing issue at that time. Basically, that'll be the first time that issue will be before us. Is there any further discussion on House Bill 2126, which will be seen again on Wednesday afternoon? Okay, if there's nothing else on 2126, we'll carry that over to Wednesday afternoon. 2429, Mr. Kornberg, you bring some folks up with you. Thank you. Si, why don't you, I think we've got the endorsed version of 2429, why don't you just tell us a little bit what that's about, and then introduce the folks with you, and they can tell us what it is in 2006 that we ought to consider.
All right.
At this time as well.
I know you have one concern on that, and I looked at it, and I think I can...
Counsel will share with members a copy of 3006.
You have a copy.
Si Kornberg, President of Federation of Oregon Parole and Probation Officers. My right is Ray Ferns, who's the Vice President of the Southwest Region from Eugene. To my left is Chuck Edson, former Vice President from Eugene, is our representative on the Congress Commission Against Violent Crime. Also in the room is Marilyn DeSophie, who is from Marion County Community Corrections, member of the Federation, and the liaison with the sex offender program at Oregon State Hospital, to answer any questions you may have. 2429, as amended, enables us to use the lead system that we presently use for the tracking of parolees and probationers, expanded by entering in cities and counties of residence, and enables law enforcement then to access that by offense number. Those offense numbers are standardized NCIC offense numbers for all offenses, including sex offenses. And what it would basically do would be that any offender under supervision for parole and probation is on that system, that if a sex crime happened in Salem, the Salem Chief of Police could ask for all of that type, say strong-arm rapes, rapists, under supervision in Marion County or in Marion County, City of Salem, and that information would come to him from the lead, from LEDs, and it would give the name of the offender and the probation officer to the office, and they could contact them, give the information they needed from about the person, person's whereabouts, and whatever, as an aid to the tracking of sex offenders. This bill also ups the parole on sex offenders to 5 years. I talked to Bob Watson, he said, he assured me there is no significant impact on that. There are not that many sex offenders under parole. Most of them, the great bulk of them, are on probation. And so so there is no, he indicated there was no significant fiscal impact to that. But what it does, if somebody makes it for 5 years, basically, they've made it. They're okay. I mean, there's exceptions, but most of them fall pretty quickly, or slip back into an odd pattern pretty quickly if they're going to slip. And we felt that this was a better than a registration, and because under the existing framework we have now, without any penalties, we keep track of the people and law enforcement has access to it. And it doesn't require the defendant to actually go register. Right now, every offender under supervision in Oregon is entered in the lead system while they're on parole and probation. Every time there's a police contact, parole and probation officer gets a notification of that, and the police get notification that he is under supervision and what he's under supervision for. But this allows them to access that that bank more specifically for specific offenses. As a matter of fact, they'd be able to access for other than sex offenses for robberies such as that. So, what we felt on 3006 was a companion type of bill.
So, excuse me, let me interrupt. Okay. You probably covered this point, I'm sorry if I missed it. It's my understanding that you have reviewed these amendments with the prime sponsor and that they meet with his approval?
That's right. They were offered by the, I met with the prime sponsor, and these amendments to the bill are offered by the prime sponsor of the bill. In other words, changing it from a proactive registration to a tracking and the ability to act for law enforcement to access slightly more information at two fields, city and county residents.
Okay. Sai, I note on the new language on page 2, where you provided a mandatory 5-year period of parole.
That's right, for sex offenders.
How many people, can you give us a ballpark figure in terms of how many people we're talking about?
We're talking about several hundred. We're not talking about any.
Should we don't have yet, at least I'm not aware of a fiscal impact statement.
I asked Bob Watson, he said it was insignificant.
We're probably going to have to get that in writing.
He told me he felt it. Most sex offenders are on, who get paroled, receive a year parole now. So, if generally...
Say, 100 a year, or 200 a year, it's my understanding, what's the cost for supervision per day for probation, $5 a day?
Something like that, yes.
So we're talking about $1,500 a year times 100 for a 4-year period?
Approximately.
Okay. I don't know if those are the assumptions, but I'm just trying to ballpark it, and I think we will have to get some form of statement.
Okay. I asked Bob, he felt that it was an insignificant amount, and that was his gut-level reaction to it. But we felt, and most of us have felt for a long time, that sex offenders especially needed a longer term of parole to have a real effect anymore. The ones that we get on parole, again, are the very worst. They're the real repetitive ones, either that or very violent. You know, the strong-arm rapists, the rapists with weapons, that type of persons who we get on parole. Initially, most of the sex offenders may present themselves very well, the child molesters.
Very often middle class, solid work records, type of thing.
So they get probation. Now, I know that the chair had a concern in 3006 on the language that said,
sorry, go ahead.
I know you had a concern on 3006 and the language that said that if the court at the time of imposing sentence finds prospective probation and intent to commit a sexual offense. I think that's just there for two areas. That's there for the person who commits who is found guilty of a burglary, and the underlying element of the burglary was the entry with the intent to commit a rape or intent to commit a sexual offense, where that's a clearly laid out intent as an element of the crime. But to get back to the overall concept of 3006, we felt, if the Governor's Commission had not asked for this, the admission, we would have asked for its introduction. We feel that the sex offender presents a unique problem, and a unique problem in supervision, and many of the courts are not that sophisticated, and many of the pre-sentence writers, unfortunately, are not that sophisticated. And this is the reverse of most offenses. We feel in most offenses, such as you deal with an alcoholic or a person with a drinking problem, it's probably better not to put all sorts of conditions on. Then as the person fails, as a person indicates a need for conditions to be added, to go in and have conditions added. The problem with the sex offender is when you do that, the reason they failed is they've gone out and molested somebody. And we feel that's really too dangerous a situation. I guess Ray has worked with sex offenders to a great extent. And Chuck, of course, has been privy to the deliberations of the Governor's Commission. And I've asked Chuck Edson to lead off with our positions.
The Governor's Commission Against Violent Crime passed this bill unanimously. It's, to my knowledge, the only matter they have passed unanimously. It's the feeling of that body that the sex offender, as Cy has mentioned, is a unique offender in many respects, but I would like to comment, I guess, briefly that the conditions of probation that statute provide now are like a generic set, I guess. I would characterize them as designed for a burglar. They address such issues as holding a job, residing in the same location, and such matters that are typically a problem for a car thief and a burglar. These matters are typically not a problem for the child offender, child molester rather, who will frequently have a stable residence, have a good job, and stay at home and commit his acts. It's also a secret kind of offense, I guess, as I've implied. The offender maintains this model appearance and can still carry out his behaviors. And about the only way you can break through his denial or denial of the offense or his behaviors or even his thought patterns is to use some unique kinds of supervision techniques, and that's what we're trying to get at with some of these, notably the polygraph, to get at the person's deceptiveness and denial. Also, our outline has here some other matters. For example, no contact with the victim without permission. And in the case of a pedophile, somebody who's showing a preference for children, we want no contact with children without permission. We also can answer some questions from Marilyn and others, Ray, most notably, if there are any concerns about how the treatment works.
Okay, Mr. Ferns.
For the record, my name is Ray Ferns.
Mr. Chairman, I appreciate the opportunity to be here to speak to the House Bill 2006. If you didn't take it personally, we're going to get that opportunity. I appreciate you taking the time for us to do that. Basically, this bill came about as a result of some concerns with probation officers throughout the state of Oregon with reference to supervision of sex offenders. The bill is kind of a consortium of a source of those concerns, and we sat down and tried to work out what we thought would be the best conditions and ideal circumstances to supervise these people. Again, I would like for you to take note that sex offenders do represent a special problem to probation control people. They do commit their crimes in secrecy. It's hard to detect these crimes. Generally rely heavily upon the police and other agencies to report crime. This is a crime that cannot be detected by the police under normal circumstances. So I think that it's very important that you consider what these conditions will do in terms of enhancing the supervision of these people in Oregon. As noted in the information information before you. There are over 1,500 people currently on probation and parole for sexual offenses. There have been some studies, one of which conducted by Robert Freeman Longo. He's a, one of the therapists at the Oregon State Hospital with reference to repetitiveness of this crime. His study indicates that out of 35 offenders, they report, these are offenders who have been sentenced to the Oregon State Penitentiary and the hospital. His report indicates that those offenders have committed over 20,000 crimes, sexual crimes. So, I hope that this body understands that it could very definitely be a problem in terms of the amount of offenses that's committed by this group of people, that we need some standardized rules or some standardized conditions in order to properly supervise them.
Okay, and this statement, we got, is this prepared by you, Mr. Edson?
Yes.
Okay, thank you. Are you gentlemen satisfied that there are sufficient community-based resources to meet the need for treatment and counseling?
I'm not satisfied that there always is that. But in the metropolitan areas, there generally is. We do have some problems, and we have had it from time to time.